Good afternoon. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, January 25th, 2021. Ahead today, an effort to support racial healing in Arkansas. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has that report in just a few minutes. In our second half hour, we'll visit with Randy Dixon from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History about the life of one of the most decorated World War II veterans and former Arkansas Lieutenant Governor Maurice Footsie Britt. After this afternoon show on Here and Now, we'll hear the latest as the House takes its next step toward the impeachment of former President Trump. Also, the reissue of Throw Down Your Heart, the musical chronicle of banjo great Bela Fleck's 2005 trip to Africa. It's up for a Grammy. Those stories and an update on COVID-19 vaccinations on Here and Now, beginning at 1. This weekend's reporting for the Arkansas Department of Health includes 57 additional deaths from COVID-19 in Arkansas. More than 4,600 deaths in the state have now been attributed to the virus. More than 2,600 new cases were diagnosed in Arkansas Saturday and Sunday. Active cases this weekend decreased by more than 700. And there are 62 fewer patients in Arkansas hospitals because of the disease than there were on Friday. There are still almost 1,100 Arkansans hospitalized because of COVID-19. Sarah Sanders Huckabee is the third person to announce a candidacy for the Republican nomination for Arkansas governor. The former press secretary for President Trump released a video formally announcing her candidacy today. Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin and Attorney General Leslie Rutledge have also declared their intentions to seek the GOP nomination. Tomorrow, Pulaski County Circuit Court Judge Wendell Griffin will consider a lawsuit filed by Northwest Arkansas bar owners against the state after Governor Hutchinson extended an 11 p.m. curfew on establishments that serve alcohol on premises through February 3rd. In the lawsuit, the bar owners argue the curfew is not based on any data and does more to ruin their business than it does to curtail the spread of COVID-19. The plaintiffs also claim similar regulations have not been placed on other businesses and activities where people congregate. Lawyers for the state say the governor, Health Secretary Jose Romero, and the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Commission have acted within their authority to protect public health during an ongoing emergency. Tomorrow morning, Judge Griffin will consider arguments about whether the lawsuit should be dismissed. The Walton Arts Center's programming during a pandemic is adding another event. The venue announced this morning it will host Broadway's next musical, an improv show allowing audience members to create song titles that the cast will then create on the fly. The production comes to Walton Arts Center March 18th and 19th as part of the Ghostlight programming series. Health protocols, social distancing, and more will be in place. Tickets go on sale Wednesday. A few clouds expected tonight with lows from 29 to 33. Not as warm tomorrow. Cloudy conditions expected. Highs tomorrow afternoon, lower 40s in northwest Arkansas, upper 50s in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. Since 2017, the National Day of Racial Healing has been observed on the Tuesday following Martin Luther King Jr. Day. The annual observance is hosted by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation and builds on the work of Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation Community Partners. Organizers wrapped up a week of events in Arkansas with a virtual press conference Friday, where they announced actions they intend to take in pursuit of racial healing in the state. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
A major goal is to pass legislation that would create a statewide Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation Commission. Kwame Abdul-Bey, co-founder of the Arkansas Peace and Justice Memorial Movement, says similar legislation did not make it out of committee in 2019. Senator Joyce Elliott, a Democrat from Little Rock, sponsored that bill and is working on the new legislation. Representative Tippi McCullough, another Little Rock Democrat, voiced her desire to sign on as a co-sponsor during Friday's press conference. Abdul Bey says the legislation will incorporate new items not included in the previous session, such as recognizing the National Day of Racial Healing as an official statewide observance, as well as creating 75 community remembrance projects that would be run out of the county judge's office. The projects would focus on historical instances of racial injustice and inequity in each county.
And begin having countywide discussions where Black, white, rich, poor, young, old, all come together at the same table and begin having discussions on the county level on how Arkansas can be number one for once. And we want to be number one as a bastion of racial healing, racial equity, and social justice in the United States. And we can do that.
The new bill will once again seek to create the Arkansas Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation Commission.
And basically, that organization will be historians, educators, elected officials, and community members and descendants who will come together to form this commission. And they will basically oversee what the 75 community remembrance projects on the county level are doing.
Another piece of the bill calls for the exoneration of the Elaine massacre defendants. In 1919, hundreds of African Americans in Elaine, Arkansas were murdered by white people in what was the deadliest racial confrontation in the state and one of the bloodiest racial conflicts in the country. Lisa Hicks Gilbert, founder and advocate for the descendants of the Elaine Massacre of 1919, says they are imploring the governor and the Arkansas legislature to take action.
Arkansas, acknowledging and facing the horror of the Elaine Massacre, the wrongful arrests and convictions of the Black sharecroppers, and the deafening silence in its aftermath is long overdue. Though we indeed should recognize the fear-fed silence of the survivors of the Elaine Massacre, we should face the injustice that needs to be corrected. We should face the fact that 122 hardworking, innocent men who were going about their business of organizing for their fair share of harvests and fair accounting of store charges, trying to make better lives for their families. We should face the fact that they were falsely accused, arrested, convicted, and imprisoned.
She says the acknowledgement helps the state move closer to true racial healing and hopefully toward a long overdue hate crimes bill. Senator Jim Hendren, a Republican from Gravette, and Representative Fred Love, a Democrat from Mabelville, have filed legislation that aims to do just that. Arkansas is one of only three states without a hate crimes law. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
The Washington County Community Remembrance Project Coalition, a group of Fayetteville citizens committed to documenting and commemorating troubling racial history, is hosting a high school racial justice essay contest. Top award winners will share a $5,000 cash prize, and the remainder of participants, gifts of appreciation. Roanne Elliott is project director for the Remembrance Project Coalition.
Yes, well, we're just so excited to be able to offer this opportunity. It's a scholarship opportunity and a chance for high school students to share their thoughts and ideas and maybe even do a little research into things having to do with racial discrimination and the challenges and triumphs of Black people in our community.
The essay scholarship contest is sponsored by the Equal Justice Initiative based in Montgomery, Alabama, in partnership with the Washington County Remembrance Coalition. EJI is committed to ending mass incarceration and excessive punishment in the United States, as well as challenging racial and economic injustice. The essay contest is open to 9th through 12th grade students attending public high school in Washington County.
I know students will want to know, what should I write about? What are the topics that I can write about? And so overall, the topic is about racial justice. And so, you know, there are many things within that. But EJI and our project will provide some help.
Help can be found at a special contest web portal at ejI.org/Washington County AR/overview. We'll link to that site on OzarksAtLarge.com. The contest opens today and will close April 23rd. Essays will be judged by EJI staff. Winners announced this summer. The Fayetteville Public Library will host a virtual essay contest workshop Wednesday afternoon at 4:30. The virtual workshop will provide a contest overview and opportunity for discussion with contest participants and interested adults. Registration required at faylib.org/events. That's faylib.org/events. This is Ozarks at Large. Tomorrow evening, retired General Wesley Clark, the former Supreme Allied Commander Europe and former presidential candidate, will deliver an address virtually as a guest of the University of Arkansas Honors College. It's free, open to the public, and pre-registration required. More about that ahead. The speech will address what's next for the country as a new presidential administration considers challenges both domestic and global. General Clark is the founder of Renew America Together, a nonprofit designed to bring civil discourse and policy discussion to the forefront. Earlier this month, we reached General Clark via Zoom to ask him about the years ahead for the Biden presidential administration and all Americans.
Well, I think you start by looking at the challenges that President Biden will face. And those challenges are both at home and abroad. They start with the pandemic, with a very high rate of unemployment. They continue with a very fractured group of people in politics in the United States. I think the people are more fractured than the, or less fractured than the politicians, to be honest with you. But the politicians are pretty hardcore going after each other. And then you have a series of challenges from abroad. You have military challenges. You have the global leadership challenge from China. You have developmental challenges still in South America, Central America, Africa. And President Biden has said he wants to restore America's global leadership. So it's going to be a pretty tough row to hoe. It would have been tough even in 2016. It's been made much tougher by the events of the past 4 years, and especially by the concern that people around the world have looking at the events just of the last month and especially the last week in Washington. So in order for America to be trusted, America's leaders have to lead America. That's the first real challenge for our president.
How connected are the, or are they connected, the concerns at home and abroad? I mean, do they dovetail?
In one sense, they really do. Since the early 1980s, we've worked steadily to, there's no nicer way to put it. We chose the private sector over the public sector as though the two were in competition, when in fact, they are synergistic. America needs a strong public sector with dedicated public servants and all the other things that come with the government that we had in the 1950s to do for us what we can't do for ourselves. We need public health. Everybody sees that now. We need to regulate markets. We went through 2008. That was a market regulation, massive failure. We need national defense. We need security at our borders. We need an immigration system that works. None of these things can the private sector do by itself. We need innovation. And in fact, if you look back historically at the United States, most of the innovation in the last 70 years has come from government investment, not from the private sector. Private sector takes the research and development money put into the Defense Department or into the National Institutes of Health or into the Department of Energy, and then suddenly, boom, it takes all the credit. But everything from fracking to the internet to space travel, it all began with government investment. So we need government. We need private sector because you have to have the initiative, the independence, the risk-taking propensities of the private sector, the organizational, and people have to be motivated. So the two are synergistic, but somehow we lost sight of that. And step by step, we have attacked government to the extent that we finally elected a president who became an enemy. He saw government as a deep state enemy, when in fact he was the leader of it. So everything from the regulations which keep our air clean and our water pure to dealing with future issues like climate change suddenly became like the wrong thing to do. But what was the right thing to do? So somehow we have to get the balance right between government and the private sector. We don't do that in the United States. Then how can these people abroad look at the United States and trust us? So in that sense, there's a real connection between what happens here and what happens abroad.
If it's taken us decades to develop and hone that distrust of government or that competition between private and public sector, it's not going to be repaired in a couple of months or a couple of years. This is going to take a long haul, I would guess.
I think it's going to be a tough process, really. I mean, I think you first have to start by going back and looking at this past election. Now, tens of millions of people believe the election was fraudulent, or at least that's what they said. They signed up to it. And we saw all these people in D.C. who said, we're going to take our country back. Well, you have the country. You voted. I mean, so we have to have a re-education or an education campaign that brings people together on the election. Maybe we need to change some of the processes in elections as part of that. But that's the start of it. And then I think government has to be more constructive. One of the things that happened starting in the 1980s is we took away from government a lot of the resources that government has traditionally had and systematically removed its authorities so it could do less and less to help people. Just in our own state, the state government used to pay most of the costs of higher education. So you went to the University of Arkansas when I graduated from Hall High School, you could go to the University of Arkansas. And it wasn't free. You still had to eat and sleep, but it was relatively inexpensive, even by the cost of living standards then. Today, it's not. It's expensive. And this is representative of state colleges and universities across the country. The public funding for education isn't there. We were all vaccinated for polio in the 1950s. That was a huge public health issue. Today, most infants or two-year-olds are vaccinated for a number of childhood diseases. But then beyond that, there hasn't been much public health. There's no malaria. Mm-hmm. There's no diphtheria. There's no typhoid fever raging among the American population. So we sort of forgot about it. We let the function wither, despite the fact we got some wonderful people doing the work. So today they're really taxed with COVID. The interstate highway system was fantastic, but look at it today. There's about $2 trillion of infrastructure repairs needed for America's highways, rail, and airports. People land in the United States after visiting China, and they think they've come to a third world country when they look at the airport situation. Now, Atlanta Hartsfield looks pretty good to us, but it's the busiest airport in the world. If you look at Beijing, go through Beijing and look at that airport and how it's set up. It's impressive. So we're not keeping up with these things that traditionally government would do. In addition, we let lapse things like, we let businesses off the hook for pensions. Hmm. So we went from a defined benefit program to a 401k program. That's better than nothing, but it means that you as the retiree take all the risks of the stock market and the corporation doesn't. And we've taken a number of measures like this, which have put the burden on ordinary Americans. We allowed industries to move out of the country to outsource. We were proud of having negotiated NAFTA, and yet all across the South, lots of people who made uniforms and for the military and packed sea rations and did things like this, sort of menial, low quality, low technology industrial jobs, they lost those jobs. That stuff moved out. And so business is quick to take advantage of profit, but it didn't repay the public costs of what it left. So these are all elements that have combined to make it hard for ordinary people, especially living in America's heartland, to see, what does government do for me? Mm. Of course, it's all encapsulated in that famous quote from the woman in 2009 or 10 who said, "Keep your cotton-picking government hands off my Social Security or Medicare." But beyond that, so many people in this state and elsewhere are struggling to survive.
It almost sounds like when you list, you know, challenge after challenge, that something along the line of a New Deal or a Marshall Plan or something that is bold and creative might be needed over the next decade or so.
It's true. We do need things. You know, when the New Deal came in, though, FDR was sort of flying blind. He put together two things. He put together the remainder of the old progressive ideas that had come out of Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, but they didn't get implemented in the 1920s. And then he put together the stuff that Woodrow Wilson did to mobilize the economy during World War I. He threw it all in a grab bag in 100 days. He tried to have labor working with management, did a bunch of things. The Supreme Court said, it's unconstitutional. They threw stuff out. There was nothing to guide. And then it was only through that experience that the famous British economist John Maynard Keynes formulated what became known as macroeconomics. In the 1960s and 70s, we became enamored with a new approach. It was the approach called monetarism. It's the economist Milton Friedman, which basically said, hey, get your cotton-picking government hands off the economy. Let the market solve things. And so we followed that response, and we got phenomenal economic growth, but we also left a lot of people behind. So somehow we have to find the new synthesis. But just like FDR, I think when President Biden comes in, he's going to have to pull a bunch of stuff together that maybe conventional economics and economists won't like it. Maybe they'll say, oh, no, you can't spend that much. Or they'll say, no, you can't give away income, or you can't raise a minimum wage, or you can't create jobs like this. So there'll be a lot of controversy about this. It'll be tough. Well, I don't think you can just flip the light switch back on and go back to where we were in 2015, 2016. Fact is, we've been pulling away from Europe for a long time. I remember talking to Condoleezza Rice when I first retired, and she came over to see me in the summer of 2000. Of course, I knew Colin Powell, and he was part of George W.'s national security team, and I knew the people in the Democratic administration. I didn't want to be partisan. So I called up Condoleezza and I said, can I talk to you about, you know, the new administration? And what she told me, she said, we're going to pull our troops out of NATO, out of Europe. They don't need them. We're going to put the troops where they need to be. I said, well, where is that? She said, the Middle East, of course. I said, but why do they need to be in the Middle East? She says, because that's where we're going to fight. So this was the summer of 2000. So there was a certain amount of de-emphasis on NATO even then. During the Obama administration, there was a pivot toward Asia. Now, we sent 2,000, we announced it with 2,000 Marines to Australia. I guess the Chinese were quaking in their boots that 2,000 Marines would be sitting in Australia. But be that as it may, the Europeans took it as the Americans aren't as interested. And so even before the Trump administration came in, and then the personal frictions have made it worse. So this is going to be a tough lift. He's going to have to reassure Europeans, but at the same time, Europeans need to be doing more for themselves. Every president has said that in the defense space. They're coasting off of us, and that's simply a fact. We chastise them for it. We kind of like it, too, because that way they have to depend on us. So but they could do more and we'd still have a good alliance. And we're going to have to expect that of them. It's going to be a little bit tougher because of Brexit.
Oh, right.
That's another factor that complicates this. So we don't have, we used the United Kingdom as the bridge into Europe. French Roy's are sticky. You know, they have their own ideas. The Germans are there, were worried about the Russians. They have a sort of guilt complex about it. And they're further east. So the Brits were the bridge for the United States. They're no longer there. Not in the same way they were. So there are challenges that we have to deal with. Turkey has become a much greater challenge for NATO. They bought the Russian air defense. Ukraine is struggling against Russian aggression. And it happened in 2014. There was a strong burst of enthusiasm for re-strengthening the alliance. But Russian money has penetrated all through Western Europe and into the United States, and Russian money buys influence. Look, do you want a nice aluminum factory in your state that's going to employ 1,000 people? If you do, talk nice. And so that kind of economic diplomacy carries weight, not only in the United States, but everywhere.
Finally, visit with the university community is open to people of all ages, of course, but I think of so many people that are involved in a university are young. And when I think of people who are 30 and younger and what they have grown up with, I mean, just start in 2000 with the presidential race decided in the Supreme Court, 9/11, the 08 crash, the growing tensions politically, the last 4 years, the last week. I mean, what do you say to someone who's 30 or younger who might be battling cynicism or pessimism?
Got to say, the system is a unique system in that it is self-correcting. It corrects itself, unfortunately, through conflict, through challenge and response. Usually that's peaceful. Once it wasn't. But normally these things can be resolved. Tempers are frayed, feelings are hurt, friends are lost, but the country, through this system of checks and balances, of what the founding fathers wrote, they said, let interest counteract and interest, let ambition counteract ambition, Federalist Papers 51. And that's basically the formula that has kept America solid as the world's oldest and safest democracy. In other systems, resentments and grievances fester. In America, they become articulated. Wasn't so happy the way it was articulated on the 6th of January, but it was a wake-up call for a lot of people on a lot of issues. So it was, if you look back at those events, you can talk about racism. You can talk about gun control. You can talk about jobs and opportunities in middle America. You can talk about the legacies of conflict. There's a lot of issues that surfaced in that. And I think it obviously shocked the world that it happened.
Retired General Clark's address to the University of Arkansas tomorrow is connected to the nonprofit he's founded, Renew America Together. The organization's mission is to promote and achieve greater common ground in the country. Part of that mission includes public discussions, as well as teaching civics, civility, and citizenship.
You know, you asked me about the challenges the president has. Of course, the biggest challenge is he acknowledges bringing the country back together. And we wanted to do our part to get, the idea was to get some post-partisan politicians, people who are no longer asking for votes or asking for money, together from both sides of the aisle to talk about politics in a reflective way to young people. What's it really like? Are the parties really enemies, or are they just people expressing interests that could be synergistic and could be, we used to use the phrase, log rolled into legislation? Could you put it all together? Or are we inevitably divided? And so we've set out over the last year and a half to do a series of talks to businesses and colleges, usually with a Democrat and a Republican, usually nobody who's in office or running for office, to be able to speak more openly about what the nature of partisan politics is, why parties are important, and why you should look at the policies rather than the personalities.
Retired General Wesley Clark spoke with us earlier this month via Zoom. He is the former Supreme Allied Commander Europe, and he will be a virtual speaker tomorrow night as a guest of the University of Arkansas Honors College. The Zoom address is scheduled to begin at 5:15 tomorrow, and while free, registration is required. You can find the form for registration by following the events tab at honorscollege.uark.edu, and we also have that link at ozarksatlarge.com. And to find out more about the nonprofit Renew America Together, simply go to renewamericatogether.org.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Park Lane Family Dental, offering dental wellness with an emphasis on restorative and cosmetic dentistry for more than 30 years. With offices in Fort Smith and Rogers, Park Lane follows CDC-recommended protocol for COVID prevention. ParkLaneDental.com for information or to schedule an appointment.
This is Ozarks at Large, just ahead on this Monday edition of our show. Our latest tour through Arkansas history, courtesy of the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. This week's subject, former Lieutenant Governor and World War II veteran, Maurice Footsie Britt. That's just ahead. A formal ribbon-cutting ceremony was held late last week to celebrate the new Oklahoma State University College of Osteopathic Medicine at the Cherokee Nation in Tahlequah. The facility, constructed by the Cherokee Nation, is the first tribally affiliated medical school in the country with a focus on educating primary care physicians with an interest in serving rural and underserved populations in Oklahoma. Because of COVID-19 restrictions, the ceremony was attended by a small group of dignitaries, including Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. In a press release, he says that the new college is a historic achievement for all of Indian country. Native Americans, he says, make up only 0.2% of medical students nationwide, and the new college will increase a shortage of diverse physicians. The 84,000-square-foot, $40 million facility opened to students, faculty, and staff just after the new year. Inaugural class president Caitlin Cosby, one of 54 medical students enrolled this first year, leads a virtual tour of the new college.
Being a Native American medical student, it means so much to me to be a part of the country's first tribal-affiliated medical school located on tribal land here in Tahlequah. Dr. Natasha Bray, our Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, is now going to take us on a virtual tour of our brand new medical school facility.
Thank you, Caitlin. The Cherokee Nation campus of Oklahoma State University College of Osteopathic Medicine represents the shared dream of leaders at OSU and the Cherokee Nation. The development of the campus here in Tahlequah allows us to meet our shared healthcare mission of training primary care providers to meet the healthcare needs of our rural, tribal, and underserved communities.
The new school is an extension of the OSU College of Osteopathic Medicine in Tulsa. The new school is located on the W.W. Hastings Hospital campus in Tahlequah, the capital of the Cherokee Nation. You can find a link of the virtual tour at ozarksatlarge.com.
And the next thing I did, roll one of those big railroad guns out from a railway tunnel and start leveling the house. And it got a direct hit. That's the last I remember until I came to.
This is Ozarks at Large. With me on the phone is Randy Dixon, who is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. We're going to go through some more archives that have been digitized, KATV archives that have been digitized. We got a little bit of hint there of our subject this Monday. What is it, Randy?
Well, that is Maurice Lee Footsie Britt, who was a lieutenant governor of Arkansas, but more importantly, he was a great war hero in World War II. And it's kind of funny the way I sometimes come across subjects, you know, for our segments. And this came actually from Sassy's Red House, the barbecue place.
The restaurant in Fayetteville.
Yes, okay. Right on College. And I was there waiting for an order to go. And Alyssa Tomlinson, who is one of the wait staff, was there sitting with me while I was waiting for the order. And she was asking me about the Pryor Center. And I was telling her about what we do and about the archives. And she said, you know, my great-grandfather might be in there. He was kind of in the news back years ago. And I said, well, what did he do? And she said, well, he was a lieutenant governor under Winthrop Rockefeller. And I said, oh, Footsie Britt. And she said, yes, that was my great-grandfather. And I said, my gosh, yes, we have all kinds of things on him. And I actually called up the Pryor Center on my phone and did a search in the KATV archives for Footsie Britt, and about 30 different clips came up.
Well, because he was so involved in so many things.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. He was a Razorback football star. He played for the Detroit Lions. And he was a Medal of Honor winner, among many other things. But I call up his name, and all these clips come up, and she had never seen any of this. Huh. And she immediately took my phone and sent the link to her grandmother.
Wow.
They emailed it to her, and now, you know, her grandmother is getting to see her father. But it gave me the idea. It was like, we need to do a segment on Footsie Britt.
I love that you've brought this up, because Footsie Britt is one of those figures. It's been long enough now. I mean, he did, as I'm sure we're going to talk about, you know, extend his political career into a couple of runs for governor.
Yes.
But the height of his popularity, I guess, sort of was, you know, beginning to decline in the early 70s. When you think about it, that's been a while. So even though he was incredibly well-known nationally and in Arkansas for some time, like his great-granddaughter, I mean, there are people of a certain age who probably have never heard of Footsie Britt.
Right, right. And, you know, he was, well, I think we need to go to this first interview. Steve Barnes interviewed him in the 70s. You know, like I said, he was a World War II hero. He was in Italy in 1944 when there was a major German attack. And they took some heavy casualties. He was a captain. You know, he was quite injured. He had injuries to his face, his back, but especially his arm. And he was evacuated by the Red Cross. And he did point out that, you know, the Germans did respect the rules of the Geneva Convention, and he was, you know, evacuated off the hill and taken to a hospital where, you know, things didn't go so well.
I remember that night when they were getting ready to operate, and I looked up at the doc and I said, Doc, you're going to save my arm. And he said, sure, don't worry about it. Well, of course, there's no way that he could. It was gall, but it reassured me. And I went, when I went under, I thought, well, I'd have my arm. When I woke up, came to after the operation, when I was coming back to reality and trying to find out where I was, I then remembered I'd been hit. I could feel my arm. I said, good, I got my arm. Then I got the feeling some more, and I couldn't feel my foot and my leg. I said, well, I guess I must have lost that. And imagine my surprise when I found out it was just the opposite. I'd lost my arm and still had my foot.
Again, we're listening to comments of Maurice Footsie Britt, who was born in Southern Arkansas, right?
Yes. Yes, but you notice at the end of the interview, he thought he had lost his leg and his foot.
Yeah.
He actually lost his arm, and he was known as Footsie. But he had been known as Footsie since he was a kid because he wore a size 13 shoe.
Right.
And so it was funny in the interview, not funny, but ironic that he had thought he had lost his foot, but he had actually lost his arm.
You know, earlier we mentioned that he was a University of Arkansas scholarship football player. I think he also played basketball at the U of A, then went to the Detroit Lions and was having a pretty good career there until Pearl Harbor. He's drafted, as so many Americans were. And if you read the accounts of the battle for which he received so many medals, it was fierce. It was almost hand-to-hand. It was close-range machine gun and pistols and hand grenades, and he came home a hero.
Yes, and I think even after he was injured, he delivered or threw, I guess you would call it, dozens of hand grenades at the enemy. So, yes, he was quite a hero. I mean, get this. He got the Medal of Honor, the Distinguished Service Cross, the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart, and received military honors from both Britain and Italy.
From what I understand, he moved to Fort Smith, right? He was kind of part of the then booming furniture manufacturing atmosphere in Fort Smith, but he did enter politics and ends up being lieutenant governor.
Yes, but before that, he was awarded this highest honor.
Oh, yes.
And yes. And as a matter of fact, here's a report from Steve Barnes about that award.
The nation's highest military honor was awarded Footsie Britt at Razorback Stadium. It was for everyone a day to remember. The hero had returned.
I accept this high award. Those men that have died and those men that are still carrying on the fight are the real heroes. And on behalf of those men, I accept this honor.
Steve Barnes, in a digitized archive from the Pryor Center. Originally ran on KETV. These have been digitized through a gift from the Tyson family and Barbara Tyson. What else do we have on Footsie Britt?
Well, now, you know, you were saying he went into business in Fort Smith, and then he decided to get into politics and switch from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party, and was, you know, working in the campaign with Winthrop Rockefeller. And in 66, became the 11th lieutenant governor and served for two terms, then decided not to run again. But, you know, here's, as a handicapped person, I guess you would say, you know, he had lost his arm, but he was speaking to a group regarding handicapped rights.
What other nation in this world has concentrated as much as we have to help the underprivileged, to help the impoverished, to help those who are handicapped, whether it be a physical handicap or a mental handicap? This work that progressing not only here in Little Rock, but all across this country, is certainly a monument to the American people. And I am most impressed with the fine work that's being done.
Footsie Britt, from KATV Digitized Archives that you can find at the Pryor Center. You can find everything that Randy and I are talking about this week. If you go to a search engine, put in Pryor Center, and you'll find more about FTSE Britain and everyone else. There is something else from the Steve Barnes interview that you've included in this week's archival tour.
Yeah, and it really rings true to what's, I think, you wonder what he would think about what's happened in the past few weeks. But Steve Barnes talked to him about what he thought about America. And it's, to me, is very moving.
What does America mean to you?
Well, I have real deep emotions about it. I get real excited, real alarmed about some of the things that are happening today, because I wonder if we have enough stamina and enough courage and enough willpower to resist a foreign power, and should we have another war. I think we maybe we've gotten soft, or we've lost some of our national patriotism, then again, I always remember that any time that this country is threatened, we've always had men and women who rise up to the occasion and meet the challenge. And so I guess I may be worrying unnecessarily, because I know that if the time comes and we're threatened again, I'm sure our young people will rally and meet the challenge. So you have to feel that way. I think this country's been good to all of us. I think our system is probably the best in the world, without a doubt. And I think it's worth defending.
FTSE Brit in an interview with Steve Barnes. Steve Barnes, of course, now with Arkansas PBS. Should, you know, I want to point out that you mentioned that he was a Democrat and then converted over to the Republican Party, which was not necessarily a move you made in Arkansas in the 1960s if you wanted to succeed. It was such a Democratic state. Different accounts. Right. Different accounts, including the one at Arkansas or the Encyclopedia of Arkansas, indicate that he left the Democratic Party, the Democrats, in the 60s because he thought he was out of alignment with their segregationist views, those of Strom Thurmond,
exactly,
and Jesse Helms. Yeah.
Yeah, really disagreed with Faubus.
Yeah.
And also, just to point out that he was offered a position as the district director of the Small Business Administration in 71 by Nixon. And he did that until 85. And then he ran again for governor in 86, but Frank White beat him in the primary.
Well, and it brings up an interesting lineage of Arkansas politics, and that is the role of lieutenant governor. And I think you're going to bring us some more lieutenant governors as 2021 unfolds.
Well, yeah. I think they're sort of the, unsung heroes. And some of them have actually served as governor for a brief period of time without actually being elected governor. And I'm talking about Bob Riley, mm-hmm, who was, also a war hero, and Joe Purcell.
Oh, yeah.
Who was prominent in the 70s. He was an attorney general, and he was lieutenant governor, and ran for governor several times. We'll check those guys out. How about that?
That sounds pretty cool. And these lieutenant governors would become governor for a few days, because so often the governor would become a senator or a congressman, or in one case, of course, president, and would leave before their term officially expired.
Right, like Dale Bumpers and David Pryor.
Right.
Which were both of those guys.
Yeah.
So, you want one more footnote?
So to speak, yes.
Yes. FTSE Britt was also a cousin to Dorothy L'Amour.
and Dorothy,
who is known for, the road movies with Bob Hope and Bing Crosby.
In fact, and I am not proud that I remember this, but in fact, in the first road movie, which is The Road to Bali, her billing comes before Bing Crosby. It's listed as Hope, L'Amour,
Crosby. That's how big a star. Yes, that's how big a star she was in the early 1940s. All right, you can find out all this information. Well, maybe not all the information about Dorothy L'Amour, Hope, and Crosby, but most of the other stuff at the Pryor Center. Just put it into a search engine. Randy, let's talk again next week.
Hey, love to be here.
Does Neptune have rings? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto manager with NASA Goddard, and this is Scratching the Surface. Neptune does indeed have rings, but certainly not as spectacular as Saturn and Uranus. Instead, the rings of Neptune are very faint and dusty. There are five main rings, first discovered in 1984 at the La Silla Observatory in Chile, then eventually imaged by the Voyager 2 spacecraft in 1989. Neptune's rings are named after the astronomers who contributed to the studies of Neptune. These are Galilei, Le Verrier, LaSalle, Arago, and Adams. The rings of Neptune are very dark, likely irradiated methane that has been compounded into hydrocarbons. This similar process is also found in the rings of Uranus. Also, these rings have gaps in between, and what resides in these gaps are moons, called shepherd moons, where shepherd moons essentially gravitationally control the dust and ice rings into circular orbits around Neptune. Such ring systems and their interactions with tiny moons still provides plenty of questions about Neptune and the ring systems, such as, how did the rings originate? Why are Uranus and Neptune's rings darker compared to Jupiter and Saturn? And do the ice from the shepherd moons interact with the rings, or vice versa? For more segments of Scratching the Surface, visit KUAF.com.
The KUAF Pluto manager, Caitlin Ahrens, studied space and planetary sciences at the University of Arkansas. She's currently a postdoctoral researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. Scratching the Surface is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
This is Ozarks at Large. There is a new world indoor shot put record after yesterday's professional track meet at the Randall Tyson Track Center in Fayetteville. Ryan Krauser, the 2016 gold medalist at Rio and volunteer assistant coach with the Arkansas Razorbacks, bettered a 32-year-old indoor record yesterday. He also made the now second best indoor effort with another attempt during yesterday's meet. He says he considers the new indoor record to be a stepping stone toward breaking the current outdoor world record. The Arkansas women's basketball team playing at Georgia tonight. Arkansas ranked 15th. Georgia is number 22. Thursday afternoon, Arkansas will host number 3 UConn in Bud Walton Arena. The Arkansas men's team now 4-4 in conference play after winning at Vanderbilt Saturday. Up next, a Wednesday night game against Mississippi in Bud Walton. And the Arkansas baseball team, ranked 14th in today's Baseball America preseason poll. Arkansas opens the season February 19th against number 3 Texas Tech in Texas.
Hello, my name is Rhonda Dillard, and I'm the KUAF Underwriting Director. Did you know that KUAF listeners are connected at home, on the road, and at the office? Your business can connect with these listeners by sponsoring programming on this public radio station. Find out more about KUAF underwriting opportunities by emailing Rhonda at KUAF.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Garfield. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors today included Antoinette Grajeda and Jacqueline Froelich. Jacqueline preparing the news about the Justice Essay Contest and the Cherokee Medical Center. Our show was produced by Timothy Dennis. Scratching the Surface, written and hosted by Dr. Caitlin Ahrens, and produced by Pete Hartman inside the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. We return with a new show tomorrow at noon and 7. That will include the latest episode of our podcast, The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas. That's on tomorrow's Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large. You can always find out more about us at ozarksatlarge.com. You can subscribe to our free podcast. You can hear each of the daily editions of our show by subscribing through any of the major podcast distributors. Thanks for spending time with us on this Monday. I'm Kyle Kellums. Take care of yourself. We'll talk again soon.